Almost without fail, the highest performers I've ever been around are always seeking out coaching. They want the hard feedback. They don't want to be patted on the back. They don't want to be told you did X, Y, and Z great. Or they do. I mean, our egos love that. But they want to also get beyond that and think, okay, but where are the holes? What am I missing? Where can I get better?
Thank you for listening to Ivy Podcast, where we feature weekly leadership conversations with thought leaders and industry experts. Now, here is your host, Cesar Romero.
Hey, everyone. Welcome to another episode of the Ivy Podcast. If you are someone that is looking to be a better leader, then this episode is for you. My guest today is Adam Griffin. He's an author, sales leader, and entrepreneur. And he is currently leading the enterprise sales for Automatic, which has one of the largest remote workforces in the world. Additionally, he's also the former founder of BodyFit, which is a fitness community of over 500,000 people worldwide. And if that wasn't enough, he's also the founder of the Vitruvian Project and Better Than Yester Publishing, where he writes about becoming the best version of ourselves. Adam, I'm so excited for today's episode, and thank you so much for being on the show.
Yeah, super excited to be here. Thank you, Cesar. It's going to be fun to chat. Looking forward to it.
Yeah, absolutely. So before we dive a little bit deeper into your background, let's start with, what does becoming the best version of yourself mean to you, in your own words?
It's a good question. And it's an answer that I think has changed quite a bit over time. Because I have really used that idea of better than yesterday, or kind of creating the best version of yourself, for a long time, probably over a decade, just personally as a kind of guiding light. But I think what I mean by that has changed a lot over the years, even though I've held on to that as a true north. I think if I went back to my mid-20s, let's say, I think that probably equated a lot more to ambition, dreaming big, setting high bars, high goals, working towards those, reverse engineering your goals, which is something I talked about in one of my books. And I think if I look at my life the past few years, I think that definition has evolved quite a bit to much less about doing and much more about removing, meaning removing cloudiness of judgment, trying to make sure ego's not making decisions, and trying to operate more from just kind of a really authentic place that's like something more central to you. So I think today, my definition around like creating the best version of yourself, being better than yesterday, is much more about like the inner work, looking at yourself internally, taking doing a really good accounting of like where you are at personally, where is your head at, what is holding you up, what is keeping you from being that better version of yourself. I think that the easiest way to think of it is, we all know when we're our best version of ourselves. Like, we feel it, our energy is high, we're attracting things and people in our life because our energy is at a good level, things are easy, you're in probably in flow state much more often. So we all recognize these moments in our life when we are at this, like operating at a different level. So I think it's much more about paying attention to that and trying to dissect like what is it that causes this? Like, what is the difference in that day that I wake up on top of the world, on fire, ready to go? And what is that day that I wake up like, I don't want to do this again. Like, there's distinct differences. And I think taking the time to investigate that question is so critical. And I think that's the path, at least currently, to creating the best version of myself personally.
Yeah, no, I love that, Adam. And a couple of things I want to echo here is that the answers are, you know, within ourselves, right? Like no one can give you these answers of what is the best version of yourself, right? Because it's inner work, as what you mentioned, right? And I've definitely, through practice, through trial and error, I have become better at identifying when I'm in the flow or when something is just not resonating with me. And it's something that we're, you know, my parents didn't teach me that, school didn't teach me that. It's something that I have to come to learn, like, what is this that I'm feeling inside, right? What is this, I guess, intuition or whatever you want to call it. But yeah, I think it's so important to listen to that, right? Because emotions are there to guide us, you know, some weird way, right? Like if you're feeling something's not resonating, and it's worth looking into that. So how do you bring this into your work at Automatic? And maybe before we jump into that, for those that are not familiar with Automatic, just give us like a brief background on what is the problem that Automatic is solving, and you know what they're about.
Sure. So Automatic is was founded by the co-founder of the open source WordPress project. So if you go back 16 years or so, Matt Mullenweg founded the open source WordPress project and is still the lead developer on the project today. And he founded Automatic about a year after to basically build products and services on, mm-hmm. you know, into this open source community. And so WordPress as a software and Automatic as a company, like the mission is really to democratize publishing and has been from the beginning, meaning we have this thing called, you know, the World Wide Web, the open web. And this is a place where people can have a voice and publish content. And, you know, what started out as primarily a blogging platform, mm-hmm. If you go back all those years, has really evolved into a platform that it powers Fortune 500 businesses, online presence, it powers e-commerce stores, all sorts of stuff. So that's what Automatic does. We're in the web content space. And I particularly focus on the enterprise space of large companies utilizing mm-hmm. WordPress.
Yeah, no, I mean, I've been, if you're around our age, right, you definitely use WordPress at some point in your life.
For sure. We just hit the 40% mark. 40% of sites on the web are powered by WordPress.
Yeah, my first blog was on WordPress. Nice. You know, as I was getting into the internet and putting my thoughts into the World Wide Web.
Yep. My, so when I was early 20s, my wife and I and our buddy, we owned an online greeting card company, and we built our company blog on WordPress. It was called, it's still around too. It's lifeshouldbesimple.wordpress.com, but it's so fun. It's like going back in time, going in the Wayback Machine, looking at sites from the early web is pretty fun to do.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So there's two things I want to dive into your work at Automatic. One is your role that you have right now as a enterprise sales leader, and the other one as a team builder. Right, as someone that recruits and hires and trains. So let's start with your role specifically. What are some of the biggest challenges that you are tackling in your role?
Yeah. So we're in pretty heavy scale mode right now, mm-hmm. which is a bit unique for a company that's been around for, you know, 16 years. But we're I think content is even more critical and present today and more relevant today than any point in history, and will only continue to be so. So mm-hmm. Automatic continues to grow alongside the web, alongside the growth and the importance of content. So challenges right now, a lot of them come down to scaling. Scaling companies is hard, not just the revenue side of things, but organizationally. How do you scale in a meaningful way that is not everyone constantly working, that is not everyone being, you know, pushed to their red line every day, that is retains culture, retains happiness? Like, how do you build a team that still, you know, loves their work while also changing all the time? Because scale is change ultimately. It is intentional change that sets you up for the future iteration of your organization. And so how do you keep culture and just kind of the joy of work high amidst all of that change? So that's probably the biggest challenge. And there's a lot of things nested within that, but that's my current state.
So how do you tackle those challenges? Like, how do you make sure that you keep the culture and that you keep things aligned, right? Especially when you hire people, right?
Sure. So we have a saying at Automatic, which is pretty central to the way we work, which is communication is oxygen. And I would start there. Like, if you're not communicating well, it's very difficult to do much of anything, much less scale a large business. So we are hyper communicative, and we're also try to build a culture of hyper honesty in our work. So we want hard conversations. We want continual feedback. We want people to feel empowered to have an opinion about something. And so it's very much a culture of transparency, of communication. And so that honestly doesn't solve the problems of scale, but it makes it digestible. The other thing is, like, making sure you're seeking a diversity of opinions. That has implications in hiring, that has implications in decision making, that has implications in culture itself. And so making sure we're not kind of existing in a silo, we're getting opinions, we're seeking out intentionally a diversity of opinions. And, you know, I think, and ultimately leadership's job is to listen well and make a decision on how to move forward based on observing, listening, and also intuition and past experience, and making a call and moving forward from there.
I'm really glad that you mentioned communication, because, you know, it's one of the first things that suffers when a company grows and scales. So if you don't have the right systems and processes and the right leadership in place, right, that can become toxic for the company. So now, Automatic is one of those companies that attracts a lot of people, right? Because it has a reputation and also the culture, right? Mm-hmm. Everybody wants to work at Automatic. How do you weed out those candidates that are in it because of the perks, I guess? Sure. And those candidates that are in it because, hey, these are my people and I truly see myself, you know, in this company?
Yeah. It's a great question. And it's very, very on the nose. We call them fanboys and fangirls. Like, there's a lot of Automatic fanboys.
Yes, the fanboys.
I think honestly, they weed themselves out, because if you think about, if you put yourselves in the shoes of someone building a team, someone hiring, like, the least possible interesting thing you could say is the thing that everyone else says, like, I want to work for Automatic because, you know, I love the culture,
right?
I love the reputation. It's like, well, yeah, you and everyone else. So
yeah,
they weed themselves out in the sense that you're saying the things that you think are compelling about you, but you're actually just saying the same things that everyone else is saying. And so it's like, you're not that is the last way you want to stand out, is by saying the same, the thing that everyone already knows. Yes, it is a great culture. It is as good as advertised. It is a wonderful company. And we have to get beyond that. What I love, I will say that idea doesn't extend to the WordPress software itself, though. And what I mean by that is a lot of people genuinely love WordPress because it is the thing that grew up alongside the internet. It is the thing that gave so many people on the web a voice. It really like pioneered blogging and the idea of the open web and open source technology. It was very core to a lot of the early movers in open source. And so people that come here because they genuinely love the software and what it does for the world, that's a different story. But so the short answer is they oftentimes weed themselves out, and then we can start looking at what are the other compelling reasons they want to be here, and start from that place. And also, not everyone has to want to be here deeply. Like, even though Automattic is, it is one of those companies that attracts a lot of people that just want to work for the company. But there's also people that have never heard of Automattic and that don't have deep WordPress stores. And I love those people too, because then you get to sell them on like why it is such a good place. And so that is equally as fun, I think, is people that aren't familiar with the impact that the software and the company has had on the world, and getting them bought into what we're doing.
Yeah, I mean, I'm one of those people. I didn't know about Automattic until recent. You know, I always associated Matt with WordPress.
Sure. Right?
But not Automattic.
Sure.
So if you have an interview with Adam, do not tell him how much you love the culture, because he's going to be like, okay.
That's good advice. Honestly, you probably don't make it past the... resume screening stage if it's answers like that, but that's okay. And I don't want to bash on people. I know I've probably done very similar things in my career, so
yeah. No, we all do, right? But I get your point though, right? Like, don't tell me how much you love the culture, the product. I mean, it's great, but show me what you can do, right? Show me how you would fit into what we're building, right? I think that might have a better impact
for sure. Yeah, you got to find your people, which I think is so much more important than finding a company. You got to find people and values that you align with. And sometimes that's a startup you've never heard of. Sometimes that's a big corporation that, you know, maybe we think is boring from the outside, but is actually specifically where you'll thrive. So yeah, I think company is generally a poor indicator of whether or not you'll thrive at a place.
Speaking of finding your people, like for you as a hiring manager, right, in a sales role, what are some of the things that you'd look for in your people, right, that are going to be part of your team?
Yeah. For one, DEI is incredibly central to hiring. Both for me personally and Automattic broadly. And that kind of ties back earlier to like diversity of opinions, diversity of experiences, diversity of backgrounds, diversity of individuals generally. I think we unintentionally build ourselves blind spots if we're not operating from a place of diversity, equity, and inclusion. So, and then from a skills standpoint, I look for a few things above all others. I look for curiosity, which is, I think people that are genuinely curious make incredible salespeople, because they ask questions, they follow, you know, little carrots to learn more. They want to understand someone's business. So curiosity is big. If you're not curious, I think it severely limits your ability to do a sales role effectively. They're really good listeners. Really good salespeople are really good listeners. They pay deep attention, and they shepherd a conversation based around what they're hearing. So it's active listening. It's absorbing and also extending the conversation in particular directions because of what they're hearing. And then the third thing is coachability. We're pretty intentional about building a culture of feedback. Mm-hmm. We even build coaching into their hiring process. And that comes from a place of like, if you're not coachable, then no one can help you. No one can help you see your blind spots. No one can help you get better. What's ironic about it is almost without fail, the highest performers I've ever been around are always seeking out coaching. They want the hard feedback. They don't want to be patted on the back. They don't want to be told you did X, Y, and Z great. Or they do. I mean, our egos love that, but they want to also get beyond that and think, okay, but where are the holes? What am I missing? Where can I get better? And so starting with that mindset, is I think critical in success in any field, but it's something in particular that we look for in the hiring process quite a bit.
I'm curious about that because that's something that you know if you don't have the right process in place, it's hard to measure if someone is coachable or if someone is a good listener, right? You know, through the interview process. So how do you make sure that a candidate successfully meets this requirements?
Yeah, it's a fair question. It's, you know, I think the particulars take different shapes and it's changed over time. I used to have an actual coaching call as part of the interview process. So where I would have someone deliver me or have a mock like sales conversation with me. And the intent was not how well they did in the sales call. The intent was after the call, I would coach them on what I thought went well and what didn't. And then we get to the whole underlying reason of why we're doing this. And I'm just paying attention to how are they responding to that feedback? Mm. Do they go blank? Do they perk up? Do they pay attention? Do they listen well? And then we actually would jump into a second we would redo this mock sales call, and I want to see it. Did they actually listen? Did they incorporate the feedback into the conversation moving forward? So that's one way I've done it. Now it's a bit more subtle. We will still have a mock like sales call, but we'll do it with a group of people on the team. And immediately after we stop the mock sales call, we go around the horn and the team gives feedback directly to the person, both good and constructive feedback. And so what they did well, and then also areas to improve. And it's a similar methodology where I'm just observing, I'm seeing how they're responding. What are like the nonverbal cues they're giving? And that can tell you quite a bit about, you know, the way someone is, at least in their current state, is wired for coaching. And coachability, by the way, is not some hardwired trait. It's something anyone can make a decision to be coachable today. It's the decision to remove emotion from feedback and to take it as what it is, which is constructive. And you remove the emotion from the feedback and the ego from the feedback. And that's a decision thing. So you can do that in the next 5 minutes if you want to.
Yeah, I agree with that. It's a decision that you can make right now. And I'm a big fan of the four agreements. Don Miguel. And one of the agreements is do not take things personally. Right? And I think that it's important, right? Because we have to be humble, right? We have to be open to how others perceive our actions, you know, feedback. And yeah, it's such an important trait to have.
For sure. It's interesting how tied together the different aspects of work are, because like, you know, we were talking about culture a little bit ago, and this is one of those things that might seem separate from culture, but it's deeply entwined, because if you have a highly coachable group of people, your communication can be more open and honest. Yeah. People aren't afraid to give their opinions. People have a respect for giving and receiving feedback. And so it's like, culture gets this spotlight, but culture is this aggregation of so many moving parts. This being one of them. Like, if you can't start with coachable people, it's very difficult to build a culture that is not centered around the egos of the individuals within it.
Yeah, no, 100%. Being coachable, I feel it's such an underrated skill set, but it can have so much return of investment, right, in the culture and on you as a professional. Great. So I want to shift gears here a little bit and transition from Automatic to your time with BodyFit. You and I met when you were still running BodyFit, and I was actually a user of BodyFit because I love the idea of someone or this app just giving me my workout for the day and just doing those workouts, bodyweight workouts, by the way. And I'm curious about your journey with BodyFit. Like, why did you decide to leverage content marketing and partnerships as a strategy to grow the community to over 500,000 people?
Yeah. the decision is probably not that fun of an answer, but it is the truth. So I started BodyFit as a side project. I'll give a quick backstory and then I'll answer your question a bit more directly. But yeah, I was working for a technology startup at the time and was pretty heavily involved in CrossFit. Back then I was coaching CrossFit just for fun and very deep in my local CrossFit community. And I saw firsthand the positive impact CrossFit had on the community broadly. Me personally, yes, but more so than that, because I had always been into fitness and I would have been into fitness regardless of CrossFit. But what I love was watching what it did for people that wasn't their story, that fitness was new to them, or it helped them overcome various things in their life. Like, I loved seeing those stories. And what the whole intent behind starting it as a side project was, like, CrossFit is unapproachable for a lot of people. It was then, it is now. Some people are just too intimidated. I'm like, how do I make a community like this more accessible to more people? Like, that stay-at-home parent that doesn't get out of the house, they don't know how to start, they don't know where to start. Like, how do I reach that person? Or the person that, like, just they have self-confidence issues. They're not going to carry themselves into a gym. They're not going to take themselves to CrossFit and rip that Band-Aid off. Like, how do I reach that person? So that was the underlying intent behind starting it as a side project. It grew really quickly out of the gate. Like, I think it touched on a nerve. And it seems silly now. If you go back to the time when I started it, the idea of, like, daily workouts and workout apps, it wasn't much of a thing. Like, there was CrossFit, they had their workout of the day.
Yeah.
But that was pretty much it from that perspective. And so it was a bit novel at the time. It grew really quick, I think, because of that novelty, and it struck the right chord with people. And so I decided to leave that startup and run it full time. And the decision to grow through content marketing was purely one of, like, I didn't have the intent or the desire to build some, like, big fitness tech company. I didn't want to go raise capital. I had worked for venture funded startups, and there's trade-offs that come with venture capital. And so that just wasn't a path that was interesting to me. And so I had to just be creative about, okay, well, how do I grow this thing in a manner that doesn't require a bunch of capital and something that I can drive myself? And so content became that thing, because I had been writing. I loved writing. I knew a bit about the online content world. And so I just started literally writing down, like, the publications that I wanted to be in, you know, setting that kind of big, hairy, audacious goal. And I just started working towards it. So I think when I left the startup, the first thing I did was I set a goal of being in these five publications by the end of the year. It was January. So I had a year to do it. And I accomplished it within the first like 2 months, which means I probably did not set a ambitious enough goal. But that's when I knew like, okay, there's a path here. Like this is repeatable. This is sustainable. This is a great way to grow. And it just worked for me. It worked for my skill set. It worked for my personality. And it allowed me to grow in you know, a way that didn't depend on money.
Yeah, no, I love the app, especially at the time I was traveling a lot, right? Running trips with Matt from Honor to the Experiences. And I love the app because it was quick. I could get the workout done. And it was something that I had not seen before. I remember that. And I know you mentioned writing and we'll get into that, but I'm curious to know, you've always been someone that is willing to serve, right? I see you as a servant leader. And I'm curious to know, like, where does that come from? Does it have to do with your upbringing or maybe something that happened throughout your career? I've always been curious about that. And I always wanted to ask you that.
Well, I appreciate you saying that. I hope it's as accurate as advertised. I think this isn't a question I've thought about deeply, but it's a great question. I think it stems from a place of my own personal values. Mm-hmm. Like I value autonomy very highly. Like I think we as humans, as these animals that we call humans, like we at our core, we need some level of autonomy and ownership over our life. Like I think when the autonomy is removed and we feel like we're just part of something else that we have no control over, I think it's difficult to set goals. It's difficult to dream big. It's difficult to envision a better future if you don't start from a place of like being an autonomous, independent human that can go create in the world.
Yeah.
So that's a very like fundamental underlying value for myself. And when I think of leadership, I just think like things like power are so antithetical to this idea of having autonomy over our lives. And so it's not to say I like go against power structures. I just approach power or leadership, and those are two different things, but I approach them both from the perspective of like, we're both humans, we need to be on a level playing field. This is not a me versus you thing. This is not a I'm up here or you're down here or you're up here and I'm down here. We can't start from that place. We have to start from a place of like, we're on the same level. Mm-hmm. Let's talk as human beings, human to human, to solve whatever it is we're trying to solve, to create whatever it is we're trying to create. And so, getting to that like place of just level setting with individuals, no matter what their position or stance is in life, I have to start from that place, or else it rubs up against my values. And if you're rubbing up against your values, I think it's a hard place to operate from.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. You know, two things here. This is why I love sports, because in a sports arena, right? Let's say soccer or football, you start as equals, right? Like each team, you know, the score is even and the team that makes a better play wins, right? And I think leadership and being a servant leader, it's very similar, right? To that, because you see the other team or the other person as an equal, right? Not above you, not below you. And there was something else I wanted to mention that I'm totally blanking out.
I like the analogy though. It's an apt analogy for sure. Yeah.
Oh yes, on the values. So you can't see it, but here on my wall I have my values. It's like a list of seven. But the reason I have it there is because I can see it every day and remind me of, you know, is this decision or is this action that I'm about to take? Does this align with my values or does it not? Right? And it's a very yes or no answer. And every time that it's a no, it's like, okay, then this is not worth it, right? But it took me a while to do that, because at first I was like, oh, you know, values, goals, mission. Yeah, it sounds very woo-woo, but whatever. But one day I decided, you know what? I'm going to write them down and just put them here and look at it every day. Right? And strangely enough, it's made a difference.
Sure.
Because I'm looking at it.
Sure,
and I'm
it has.
Like, oh, that's not going to make me happy. So I'm not going to do that.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's, it kind of goes full circle to the beginning of the conversation in that, like, it's, I just think it's difficult to create that best version of yourself if mm-hmm. you're not doing the work to understand what your values are and aligning the way you show up in the world to those values. I think when we're younger, like, you know, again, how that definition has evolved, like early 20s, mid 20s, there's energy, there's ambition. But it's generally, unless you're an old soul or you're raised by very wise parents, you know, it's, you haven't done the deep work to understand mm-hmm. internal values, to understand what's intrinsic to you, to understand how you're wired. And that's okay. I don't think that's a problem. But at some point, we start to evolve a bit and we start to understand how core operating from this internal space is mm-hmm. to our own happiness and to our own like contentedness in life. So it's
I wanted to shift to writing, because I know writing is a big part of your life, and I know that you have mentioned in the past that writing is a vulnerable act. Describe what you mean by that. You know, why do you consider writing a vulnerable act?
Yeah. So I'll speak to a particular kind of writing, which is the type I do, like nonfiction, personal development.
Yes.
Because I think your fiction, you know, your novelist might have a different take on this.
Totally fair.
What's funny about personal development writing is that as the reader, you think you're reading from an expert, someone that has solved all of these things they're writing about.
Yes.
But how this writing actually comes about, and this is not a me thing, I think this is almost every personal development writer, they're solving their own problems. Like mm-hmm. they're, because that's the stuff you have to write about. Like writers are processors. They write because it helps them understand the world around them. Mm-hmm. It's a vehicle for understanding the world mm-hmm. around them. So when you're reading that book, you're reading what the author themselves has struggled with and the mm-hmm. approaches they took. And you're not reading from a person that has perfected something. You're not mm-hmm. reading from a person that is so far ahead of you in these particular areas. You're reading from someone who has struggled with them just as much as you have and is likely still struggling with them. Otherwise, they would not be writing about them. So that's why it's a vulnerable act, is because even if it's unbeknownst to the reader, you are pouring out your own issues onto the page and you're working through them on the page. And so, that's what I love about writing. I think that's one of the biggest misunderstandings about writing. And it's that's what makes it such a vulnerable act, is once you understand that truth about what writing is, you realize quickly, it's like, oh, that person struggles deeply with the same thing that I struggle with. And the information becomes helpful in a new way, not because they've given you some secret formula, but because one, you have a shared experience with someone, and two, you get to see how they think about it. And maybe it's useful, maybe it's not, maybe parts of it are useful, parts of it are not, but you're doing the work to look at the problem itself.
Yeah, no, I definitely had this misconception of, you know, authors and writers that I put them on a pedestal because, you know, here's this person that wrote this book. He's a published author and I'm not. And I'm reading through the book and I'm finding all these nuggets of wisdom and knowledge. But over the years, I've realized that these are just people like you and I, right? Like mm-hmm. normal people that are sharing their journey, the hero's journey, right? Of their struggles, challenges, and overcoming those challenges. And I really like that you mentioned how writing is a tool to help you understand the world around you. And I'm becoming more comfortable with that. Being very vulnerable here, I struggle, right, with the writing habit. Because some days, let's be honest, I don't want to do it. You know, I don't show up. But every time I write down my feelings about something, whether it's at work or, you know, life, I feel much better. And what do you think that is?
I think it's therapy because it's holding a mirror up to ourselves. Mm-hmm. And I think, I apologize, my calendar notification.
no worries.
I think, I don't think it's dissimilar from therapy itself. Like when you go to a therapist, you are, or should be addressing something head on. You're looking it in the face, and that is what allows you to process it. Like you can't see what's in the dark unless you shine a light on it. And that's mm-hmm. effectively what therapy is. And I think that's effectively what writing is it forces you to look at something that you might not shine a light on otherwise. But what it also does is like our brains, our thinking brains are not good processors. It's very difficult to think your way through something. And writing forces you to have like conciseness of thought. It forces you to make sense of things. It forces you to distill problems down a bit simpler. Like, you know, thinking is, you can think a million miles a minute, and that doesn't mean you're doing yourself any good, but writing forces you to slow that thinking down. It forces you to distill that thinking into something actionable or discernible. And so it's, to me, it's just the most like beautiful way to approach problems. And there's no better way from my perspective to think through something, to think through that thing that you struggle with, which allows mm-hmm. you to create that next best version of yourself. I'm probably the opposite of most writers. Like like you mentioned writing habit. I don't have a writing habit. I have mm-hmm. gone through phases where I have writing habits. But I've really detached from that idea that writers have to be these like people that treat it like a job. They show up to the table every day for however long. That works for so many people. I think, yeah. And some of my favorite authors, they swear by that. For me, I don't think about it like that because, again, I see writing as a tool. I see writing as a way for me to see the world a bit clearer in the problems that I'm dealing with. So when I have something I want to process, I'm mm-hmm. going to write about it, whether mm-hmm. that's for other people's eyes or not. Mm-hmm. Writing will help me think through it. But there's times in my life where I don't need more writing. I need more experiences. I need more mm-hmm. energy. I need more time to just not think about being a writer, like time to just not wear the identity of being a writer and have to like feel like I have to live up to this thing of being a writer. And that's okay too. And so you know, if people build a writing habit, fantastic. If people want to build a writing habit, fantastic. But I don't think it's required to be a writer or to be mm-hmm. someone who writes.
Definitely resonate with that, especially with all this advice you see on social media that you need to have a writing habit. You need to do this.
It's very in vogue.
Yeah, I think what you said, it's so true, right? Write for yourself, write when you feel like you need it. And then when you don't feel like you don't need it, then go out and experience, right? I think that's awesome.
That's one thing I picked up on later in my writing career. That wasn't as obvious to me or earlier in my writing career is that there is no writing without experiences. Mm-hmm. And so to tap into like that creative energy is stirred by novel things. It's stirred by new experiences, and those new experiences give you a different way of looking at something. And then it starts with like a seedling of an idea, and then it grows into a bigger idea, or it takes mm-hmm. a different path. But none of that can happen without having a life of experiences. And I don't mean like traveling the world. I mean like leaning into life, engaging in life, mm-hmm. The normal throes of life, and paying close attention to those. And so sometimes I step away from writing completely, and I just focus on like, I need more inspiration. I need more experiences in my life, because they'll trigger different thoughts. They'll trigger new ways of seeing things. It's very similar to reading to me. Like, I don't need to read any more books. I have read enough about every topic that's interesting to me yeah. for far too long. So I don't read to gather new information. Mm-hmm. I read to gather more dots. So if you think about knowledge, as a bunch of different dots. Mm-hmm. Imagine a poster board in front of you. You've got millions and millions of dots. And this is like the aggregation of your knowledge or things you've read or learned about the world. Reading is not because you need like more information. It's because the more dots you have, the more information you have, the more connections you can start making on that board. That's where novelty comes from. That's where creativity comes from. That's where inspiration comes from, is not gathering some piece of new information. It's being able to see the world differently because you've connected dots that you have not been able to connect historically. I think that's where like the magic of writing is like Mark Manson is brilliant at this. He's written several good books. Mm-hmm. What I love about him is nothing he's saying is new. These are not novel ideas, but he has a completely different lens on him because he's connected dots that people haven't connected before. And that's why it resonates so much, not because it's some novel idea, but because the way he's viewing the information is novel.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of Mark Manson as well. I think him and James Clear are one of my top people out there, writing about real personal development, you know, habits.
Yeah.
Adam, absolutely. We could spend hours talking about personal development, writing, leadership. And one last question for you, since we're talking about reading, what is one thing that you're reading now, or a book? It could be a book or a course or anything that you're trying to connect the dots.
Yeah. So I am about to finish a book called A Course in Miracles Made Easy. Cheesy title. A Course in Miracles was not something I was familiar with until recently. I heard about it on a podcast. They asked someone, you know, what's the one book that's had an outsized impact on your life? And they mentioned A Course in Miracles. I was like, oh, that's surprising. I've never heard of this thing. So I do some research, and it turns out, it's a book written in the 1970s, I believe, by a psychologist. And the my elevator pitch for it will not do it justice, but A Course in Miracles is this. I haven't read the actual text, to be clear. It's a super dense text from everything I've read about the reviews. And this psychologist basically looks at the Bible and effectively says, like, I think we've been misinterpreting this thing wrong quite a bit. And she applies like a psychological slant to the truth that she pulls out of the Bible. And regardless of religion, because it has been equally useful from everything I've read to people that don't believe anything, to people that have a wide range of beliefs. And so don't think of it from a religious context, because it's much more about like psychology and personal development than that. But man, it has been a really good read. I actually just bought a copy of it for a buddy yesterday. I think it's fascinating for the same reasons, ironically, that we were just talking about. Like, it is introducing information in a new and novel way where you're like, wow, I have never thought about that like that.
Yeah, those are the best books.
The best books. Anyways, the book I said is A Course in Miracles Made Easy, which is this guy basically took this super dense text and made it a lot more accessible. So he breaks down the core themes and the core takeaways, and it's been a fun one.
Awesome. I'm gonna have to go check it out.
And then I would be remiss to not also talk about The War of Art, which is the book I recommend and give probably more than any other book.
Yes, I have that book. And funny enough, the irony is that I have resistance to reading it.
The ultimate irony. If you give it the beauty of Stephen Pressfield's writing is that some of the chapters are, you know,
yeah,
a quarter of a page or half a page. So if you can commit to a minute of reading, you might be able to build some.
Yeah, I need to put it on my night table. So Adam, what would be a one takeaway in terms of leadership that you want to close and want the audience to take from this episode? What would be your one advice around leadership?
It would, yeah, I think the best leaders are human leaders. Like, you know what you're getting with them. You're not getting a facade, you're getting the human. And I think that single attribute unlocks so many other things within leadership: trust, confidence, energy to achieve difficult things. Like, I think it is best unlocked by starting from a very human place. And so I'm not a perfect leader by any stretch, but I try to be the most human leader I can. I try to connect with people where they're at. I try to get to know them beyond the quota, beyond the task at hand, and start from that place. And I think, you know, we spend so much of our life working. And if it becomes this thing that we have to like isolate from the rest of our life, that becomes this like other version of ourselves, and then we've got our non-work life person, I'm like, I think that's maybe the saddest way we can pass a life, because we work for most of it. And if we're passing that time being someone that is not, you know, core to who we are, it's just a wasted opportunity, I think.
Adam, thank you so much for being on the show. And I'm really looking forward to getting you on another episode and dive deeper into some of these topics. But for now, thank you so much.
Awesome, Caesar. So good to see you. Thank you so much. I appreciated the conversation and looking forward to next round.
We hope you've enjoyed this episode of Ivy Podcast. Please take a moment to rate, review, and subscribe on your preferred podcast listening platform. We really appreciate that effort. Until next time.